This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you here with us. Still, we are switching gears here, about to have an interesting conversation here live at 410-319-8888. Writing us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook page, tweet me at Mark Steiner. About to talk to Dr. Carla Kaplan, who's the Davis Distinguished Professor of American Literature at Northeastern University. She is the author of this new book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance, which focuses on this on six women in particular of a group of large women, about 60 women, who crossed the color line and all its contradictions therein. She's also the author of The Erotics of Talk and Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters, which was an incredible book. We did not interview her for. That was my problem. And Carla Kaplan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This time.
This time. And there'll be a next time.
That's so, right. There you go.
So, Carla, let me, if you don't mind me calling you Carla.
Not at all. Please do.
The number here, by the way, is 410-319-8888. So this book, looking at six women out of 60-odd women who were white, who kind of crossed the color line and became part of the Harlem Renaissance, let me just take a quick step backwards, because part of this was inspired by the book I mentioned that you wrote on Zora Neale Hurston. That led you to this, right?
That's right. I was doing a collection of Zora Neale Hurston's letters, did not realize until I was partway through that book that it was going to be the first collection of letters of an African-American woman artist, intellectual, or writer. Just didn't know it was going to be a sort of a phenomenon. But I did know that there were not many collections of the private writings of black women. I thought that was very important to get them out there, because black women have had so many reasons to hold back in public on what they really thought was going on in American culture. And one of the things that was interesting but not much known in the scholarship about Hurston was how important her white friendships were to her, not just emotionally, but she was someone who, Hurston always vacillated between bursts of huge optimism about the future and much longer periods of deep, deep, deep pessimism about interracial relations. And sometimes when she would hit her lows or hit her highs, she would turn for a kind of comfort to the fact that she had these important white women friends. So they had this very important symbolic place for her, and I was trying to find out more about these white women who were part of the Harlem Renaissance, who were not just tourists going to the nightclubs. And the more I looked for these white women, the less I was able to find about them. So in the context of trying to flesh out, as it were, Zora Neale Hurston's life, I went looking for these white women and noticed that really there was very little about them. Or if there was anything, it was the same few sentences repeated over and over again. And I kept looking for a book on the white women of Black Harlem, and including when I was done with the Hurston, I really wanted to read such a book. And I finally realized, okay, the only way I'm going to get to read that book is to write it. So that's where this book on the white women of the Harlem Renaissance came from.
So I'm curious also why you think, I want to get to some of these women, the six that you've chosen in this essay. You could have chosen a great many more, but you chose these particular six women. And I want to get back to Zora Neale Hurston, especially when it comes to Fanny Hurst. But let me begin by asking you this. Why you thought this is an important study, why you wanted to get into this. I mean, I know that there's a history in America, this history of race, racism, and sexuality are all intertwined in such deep, unconscious and conscious ways in our society. This feeds into it.
And you said that beautifully, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story, because in this story we see that intertwining in such a vivid way. But another reason to tell it, and in some ways the simplest reason, was that I realized this was one of the last truly untold stories of the 1920s and of the Harlem Renaissance, a period that remains just perennially fascinating to so many of us. And we know so much about the 1920s, and yet here was a story about the 1920s and about Harlem that was completely unknown. That alone would have been reason to say, oh, you know, this gap needs to be filled in. This missing piece needs to be supplied. But as I started doing the research and really delving into what it meant for these women to not only go into Black Harlem, but to go into Black Harlem in the way they did, which is to say they wanted to be serious contributors to a Black movement. Beyond that, many of them were looking to do something completely unheard of in the time, which was to not only say whiteness is a problem, but to try to take responsibility for it as white women, to say whiteness is a problem and I need to do something about that. This was such an unthinkable thing to do at the time. People, we all have a certain image of the 1920s, and many of us carry an image of the 20s as a kind of free and easy period with a lot of parties and a lot of taboos falling by the wayside. But this was a period in which the race line was not a taboo that was falling by the race side, but on the contrary, this is the period in which the spikes in racial violence, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the incredible proliferation of racial lynchings throughout the nation, in which segregation is being enforced, not let go of. So what these women did was almost unthinkable, and that really held my interest. And the more I looked at them, the more they began to look like women of today. The more I began to see in them a set of struggles that sounded incredibly familiar to me over identity, whether we're stuck with the identity we're born with, if we can choose another identity, can we choose a better identity? Could we say identity is allegiance or is desire, that it's not blood or biology? We see these debates all over the place. And the more I looked at these women, the more relevant they seem today. So that was the third reason to tell their story.
Now, wait, because one of the things, we're on the cusp of this period of time when America in some ways was, as you write a bit about here, was obsessed with, had just been obsessed with Jack Johnson and his white wife and
yeah.
And the sexuality of a white woman and a black man being together. On the other hand, you also write about, in the earlier part of the book, Chandler Owen, one of the writers in the Messenger, one of the great black radical journals of the earliest 20th century, writes about how this part of Harlem where whites and blacks came together, where people drank and ate and sang and danced together, was part of this kind of revolutionary, as part of a social revolution that we needed to push, not pull back on. So it was this juxtaposition going on at the moment.
And the juxtaposition is so important for people to remember, because if it was true in the 1920s, as I think it was absolutely true, that racism was always a love-hate phenomenon and that it was possible in a moment of deeply entrenched national racism, and the 20s was a period of just deeply entrenched racist ideology, for there to be this vogue for blackness and this love of black culture and this nightclub fascination. And this is a period in which there is a separate tourist industry just for whites who want to go to Harlem. So if you live in Kansas and you're making your once-in-a-lifetime vacation to New York City, there are special maps for you of where to go in Harlem to see the nightclubs. They're called pleasure maps. And there are special tourist guides and sections of tourist guides written just for white tourists, because the fascination with Black Harlem was so profound and it ran so deep. And Harlem was very much divided over whether or not this was a good thing. Chandler Owen called it a marvelous race laboratory. And he said, yeah, look, the fascination in us is limited, let's face it, right? White people have certain ideas about us, and they're really stuck in those ideas. But right now, they're really into us. They're really fascinated. This is a good thing. Let's encourage them coming up here. Let's look at these little moments of interracial socializing as a laboratory, because the more they see of us, the less they'll fear us. But Chandler Owen's position was not by any means the only position in Harlem. There were many black Harlemites who deeply resented this vogue for black Harlem and who deeply resented the tourist industry. So into that, a group of white women who want to be much more than tourists and who fully recognize that the tourist industry was really geared not to white women but to white men. So this vogue for Harlem was something that white men were very much encouraged to dabble in, to take advantage of, to enjoy. It was another thing altogether for white women in any way other than escorted by white men to one nightclub to go into Black Harlem. So they were also crossing not just a line of sort of casual to serious, but they were crossing a gender line.
So let's talk about some of these women, because they were really all over the map. And you could have chosen any number of people, but you chose these particular women. And some of them, I mean, I thought I might like. Some of them I thought I wouldn't like at all.
And were your instincts borne out, or did you change your mind?
No, I really didn't. I mean, I think that when I read about, I immediately did not like Charlotte Osgood Mason.
Right.
I never did end up liking her in your book, but but you know, then she's juxtaposed. Then there's people like Nancy Cunard,
yeah,
of the Cunard line, very complex woman, but and Amy Nathan Mayer, and I felt terrible for Fanny Hurst.
Yeah.
But let's talk about these people. I mean, because they all are emblematic of different reasons and the kind of and how racism is infused in all this, and they're wanting to get rid of racism is infused in it as well. Like Nancy Cunard, start with her.
Well, so this is exactly right. Let me just say, every single one of the six I focused on women, all of whom really did want to take responsibility for whiteness and contribute meaningfully
right.
to an anti-racist movement, but every one of whom carried her own background into Harlem with her and into her anti-racist work, and that background was often filled with all kinds of prejudice. And none of them managed to completely leave that at the door. Another one of the ways I think they speak for us today, because we all carry our own backgrounds with us into the work that we do. They each exemplified in different ways the ways that white women tried to become activists and participants in Black Harlem. So some hosted parties, some were political patrons, some were editors, some were activists, some gave money, some wrote, some were lovers or mothers or wives. Nancy Cunard was all of the above.
Right.
and particularly in Britain, she was a hostess. She came to Harlem in the context of two activist causes she was pursuing. One was the Scottsboro case, and she was one of the main fundraisers in Britain for the American Scottsboro Boys, not only accused of raping two white women and part of that long history of claiming that black men were a sexual threat to white women. But very importantly, when one of the two women, Ruby Bates, when she recants and says, okay, it never happened. This rape never happened. We were encouraged by the sheriff to say it. We were scared not to say it, so we claim it never happened. The wheels of so-called justice, really in this case injustice, never stopped rolling. So part of what made the case, this incredibly important case for anti-racist progressives in the period, is even when one of the two women says this thing never happened, the black men are still being found guilty over and over and over and over and over again. Right? Trial after trial after trial is finding the Scottsboro Boys guilty. So even a white woman trying to take responsibility for her complicity and to say this never happened, her voice has very little impact. And Nancy Cunard gets very involved in the case. At a certain period, she starts saying that the woman who recanted was a political hero. That's another whole complicated story, because the recantation was done in a pretty strange and right. complicated way. But she comes to Harlem in the context of these two political movements, the Scottsboro case, and she's editing an anthology called Negro, destined to be, and it remains so to this day, the largest anthology of interracial transatlantic literature ever published. Thing weighs 10 pounds, 855 pages. Any of your listeners want to sell me a copy, they can, you know, contact me on email, because there's only about 150 left in the world.
Oh, really?
Most of them were destroyed in the war. Amazing anthology.
You made me want to have one.
Yes. Well, let me know, because they only sell for about $22,000. So
that's
let
it?
Me know.
Okay, fine.
So she comes in the context of these two things and is immediately treated as a sexual scandal by the American and the British press, which take for granted that the only reason she could possibly be in Harlem, she's an iconic flapper, iconic new woman, is that she must be sleeping with black men, who's one of the most famous black men in America, Paul Robeson. So the press claims with all of these articles that she's here to sleep with Paul Robeson. Now, they've never met, and she's actually here with her black lover, Henry Crowder, who's a jazz musician, because of whom she has now forfeited the vast Cunard family fortune.
She lost, right.
She's lost all of that money, right? So she doesn't want people saying she's here for Robes. And if she's going to lose the money over Crowder, she at least wants people to get right to get the name right. So she is partly an example of what these women were up against, that they might do very serious political things, but everything they did was dismissed and diminished by the claim either that they were crazy or that they were just sexual adventurers. And Nancy Cunard hated that. She really wanted to be taken seriously politically, and she hated that she was just treated as this sexual viper by the press.
Which is what the press would do.
Which is what the press would do, and because, what it did. And she finally sued the press, and she used the money from her lawsuits to pay for the Negro Anthology, because she didn't have any family money left. She'd been disinherited, as was Josephine Cogdell Schuyler, another wealthy woman disinherited by her family, because she crossed the color line.
By marrying George Schuyler.
By marrying George Schuyler.
And here she is, the white daughter of a Klan member.
White daughter of a Klan member. Again, somebody who had a period of being a kind of iconic new woman. She first went to San Francisco, where she became an artist model and then the lover of, in his day, a fairly well-known artist. She thought it wasn't that interesting. It was better than Texas, you know, but it wasn't that interesting. So then she went to Greenwich Village, and she thought, surely here I will find the rebel culture I seek, right? She spent 3 months in Greenwich Village, and she said, oh, this is dull as dirt. You know, this isn't what I was looking for. So she decided she would go to Harlem. She had already been publishing poetry in The Messenger, one of the most important national radical black journals of the day, which was edited by George Schuyler. So she just goes to Harlem and shows up at the Messenger offices. And they meet. They fall wildly in love. But she doesn't think she's going to really marry a black man. This is a white Texan who, however much she might experiment with this kind of, you know, emotional and sexual racial crossing, doesn't think she's going to make her life in a black community. And when she does finally marry George Schuyler, she's almost as surprised as anyone else that she goes through with it. She tries up until the last moment to back out. And she goes through with it almost in a kind of a daze, in a kind of a fog. She then has a very interesting life. She leaves behind everything in her white background, and she expects she's going to be part of the black community. And I don't think she realized fully, although she wrote about it, the skepticism with which she was going to be treated and the resentment with which she was going to be faced. So she was somewhat lonely in the black community. She had some friends. She was never fully accepted. And she dealt with it in a very interesting way. She dealt with it by passing in her writing for a series of other women, some of them much more racist white Southern women, and she would write in their voices to kind of expose the young woman she used to be. But she also wrote as a black woman.
Right.
And I love this piece of the story. Her name was Julia Jerome. She was the Black Ann Landers of her day, and she dispensed national advice writing to black women from across the country. And as Julia Jerome, Josephine could have those conversations with black women she couldn't have as herself. So rather than just be stuck where she was, right, white wife of Harlem's most important black journalist, she said, well, maybe I can be a black woman too, at least a little bit. And she wrote as Julia Jerome, which I was fascinated by.
And that one quote you have there, to my mind, the white race, the Anglo-Saxon especially, is spiritually depleted. America must mate with a Negro to save herself.
Yeah.
And she was talking about something much deeper than sexual mating.
Absolutely.
And that quote,
I'm so glad you read that particular quote, because it reveals just what we were talking about, the extent to which even as she becomes one half of Harlem's celebrity interracial marriage, and even as she becomes one of Harlem's staunchest anti-essentialists, a woman with a very sophisticated and very developed racial ideology and a complicated and nuanced racial ideology, you can see that she still carries with her a whole set of primitivist beliefs, right, which is that whiteness is somehow depleted or arid or washed out, and that it needs to be infused and revitalized by blackness, which is somehow more energetic and more childlike and closer to nature and closer to the earth. These were widespread modernist ideas, this primitive notion that you could infuse whiteness with black energy. And even as she's developing not only an anti-racist position, which is sophisticated, but one which costs her dearly, she's still carrying with her some of these earlier beliefs. And it's true of all the women in this book. It's why, as you say, they're all over the map.
They are all over the map. And some of them, I mean, to me, and we only have, unfortunately, I should have made this conversation longer. My fault. We only have 8 minutes left. We can come back another day and do some more, a little roundtable on this.
I'd love to.
I'd like to do that as well. But you have people who I think really embody the notion of primitivism in their head. And I think in their own ways are deeply flawed and racist and anti-Semitic, like Charlotte Osgood Mason, and those like Fannie Hurst, who kind of are really typical of what I would call the kind of liberal do-gooder racism.
You know, and those flipped for me when I wrote the book. I expected to be much more sympathetic to Fannie Hurst. Such an important novelist in her day, her novel Imitation of Life, while problematic in so many ways, was, as people always refer to it, a sensation in Harlem. It drew a lot of attention to the black community, and it gave her a civil rights platform, and her name is associated for the next two decades with major civil rights causes. I expected, as I looked at her, to find out she was a really earnest civil rights worker who contributed after Imitation of Life and sort of learned her race lessons. And I found the reverse. I found that she was somebody who really used that platform to her own advantage, which included not being identified really as a Jew anymore. She just wanted to be white. And of course, once she was seen in black culture, she looked much whiter than she did as a Jew in white culture. So, right? Lots of advantages for Fannie Hurst in getting a name in black communities. I expected to be nothing but critical of Charlotte Osgood Mason. She was known as the Dragon Lady of Harlem, philanthropist, somebody who believed she was the world's psychic healer. She used to refer to herself in all seriousness as a black god. She talked about healing the world by channeling black energy, and she believed she was the psychic doctor to do it. She was tyrannical with her patrons. She really exerted incredible control over all the major players, with very few exceptions of the Harlem Renaissance, Elaine Locke, Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes. And I found, to my shock, that they loved her. They genuinely adored this woman, some of them up until she died. Elaine Locke never stopped adoring Charlotte Mason. And Elaine Locke was no dummy, right? So here's this tyrannical primitivist who is dictating to blacks from her Park Avenue apartment, and I expected to detest her, and yet I found her black protégés often adored her.
But people like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston broke from her.
They broke from her eventually. Well, she broke from Hughes. He never broke from her. That was her doing. And she broke from him over a conflict with Hurston. And he never got over it. Hughes never recovered from being essentially dumped by Charlotte Mason. He always looked for an explanation, and he talked about how even thinking about it always made him physically ill, how she suddenly abandoned him. Hurston finally broke from Mason, but it took some years. And even though she was such a tyrant and had such primitivist ideas, she was also somebody whose love of blackness and who's willing to say whiteness is not very interesting and it's certainly not superior to blackness was actually welcomed by many Harlem intellectuals because there were so few white people who were saying that outside of the nightclubs. And so even she could contribute in a meaningful way, to my shock.
So we have about 4 minutes left in this segment, and we didn't talk much about Annie Nathan-Meyer and her incredible place, Black Souls.
Yeah, and Annie Nathan-Meyer was another one of the surprises. I didn't know she was going to be in the book because I didn't know she played a major role in Harlem. She was one of those older white women who, looking at the history of race in American culture, looking at the role white women had been put into as excuses for racial violence, again, that, you know, the myth of the black rapist, the claim that white women were, you know, in danger of black men, looking at that history and the failure in a collective way of white women to stand up and say, stop doing this, don't do this in our name, this is wrong, she felt that she couldn't draw much attention to herself. So she did not self-aggrandize, but what she did was write a play considered throughout the 1920s a Negro drama. And to Annie Nathan-Meyer, who always wanted to receive credit as the founder of Barnard, she spent a lifetime in search of the definite article, the. She was always referred to, that was what she wanted. She was always referred to as a founder of Barnard, and she said that was anti-Semitism, that because she was a Jewish woman, Barnard and Columbia never gave her the credit she deserved. But in black culture, she wasn't minimized and sort of diminished by the same forces of anti-Semitism, so she could have a real impact. And what she gained in Harlem was the appellation Negro playwright, Negro dramatist, somebody who had written a major Negro play, and she carried that with her to her death. She loved that she had done such a good job of talking in a serious way about race relations that her play was advertised throughout Harlem as a Negro drama. Now, it couldn't be staged. It took 8 years for it to be staged because she insists on depicting a white woman who has profound sexual desire for a black man. You cannot do this on the American stage in the 1920s, so nobody will put her play on. Finally, in the context of the Scottsboro case, the Provincetown Playhouse put the play on in 1932, and it is shut down after 10 performances.
Well, this has just been the beginning of a conversation we need to have and on this book and with Dr. Carla Kaplan, Miss Anne in Harlem, the White Women of the Black Renaissance. Carla Kaplan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. We'll return to this archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show after this very short break. This is Mark Steiner. Join me for the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit on January the 30th at the Calvert House in Annapolis. It's your turn to question the new governor-elect, Larry Hogan, and Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Mike Bush. Be part of the action determining the future of our state. Event details at thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit. And for tickets, the number is 443-524-8101 or claire.sheehan@thedailyrecord.com. Join us for the Annapolis Summit, January the 30th.